Okay, I think we're ready to roll, everybody. So let's get this webinar on the NAFS changes started. And just for everyone's information, this webinar is being recorded, and we hope to actually be posting it on our website at a future date so that everyone can revisit the conversations that occur today. My name is John Nickel with the Building and Safety Standards Branch. I will be your moderator today. A few housekeeping items before we begin. We're expecting over 500 people today, which is why some of you will be following along in link, and others will be joining us just on the phone following the PowerPoint that they received by email. You all received the email with the presentation slides. You're welcome to open and follow along in case your connection to link gets dropped accidentally. These things have been known to happen. We are presenting two webinars today, the first on doors, windows, and skylights from about 10 to 11:30, and then there's some additional code changes that were part of the same minister's order that came into effect on December 11th. They'll be covered from about 11:30 to 12:30 in the next part of the webinar. Each of these presentations is divided into two parts, and we'll be having a short question and answer period after each section. With so many people participating in two different ways, obviously no way we'll be able to answer all the questions that you may have in the time available today. However, we will eventually respond to all the questions you submit, either in the link conversation box or by email to building.safety@gov.bc.ca. We'll build a frequently asked questions resource, and that will be on our website, hopefully, that everyone can refer to later as well, along with the PowerPoint presentation. And our website is www.housing.gov.bc.ca/building. And I would advise you to start typing your questions as soon as they occur to you, rather than waiting for the breaks. Our breaks are going to be fairly short, and we will be taking the questions that already have been typed and appear at that time. Now we're going to go into lecture mode to minimize noise distractions from unmuted lines as we go forward. One final point before we begin. Everyone participating today is eligible to receive a certificate of attendance. Just email us your name and company name to building.safety@gov.bc.ca, and we will email those attendance certificates to you. Licensed residential builders or nominees of residential builders can count this for professional development credits. Now let's meet our presenter, Junichi Jensen, who has led this project from early consultations to regulatory drafting, to explaining it all to you today. Take it away, Junichi.
Thanks, John. So thanks, everyone, for joining us today. If you saw the presentation we did a few months back on proposed changes relating to windows, doors, and skylights, there will be a lot of repetition. But we have made a few changes in response to comments received as a result of that presentation and as a result of the public review as well. So the first slide here, I guess I'm going to count slides as I go along for those people that can't see the link presentation. So I'm going to start with slide two. It starts with a little bit of history about these changes. So the 2012 BC Building Code was adopted in December of 2012, and that brought in a couple of new standards. So the what's commonly called the NAF standard, North American Fenestration Standard for windows, doors, and skylights, and the A440S1, the Canadian supplement to NAF. Due to some industry concerns with product availability, we delayed that standard to 2013, to the month of July, and then again to December 2013 before that standard was those standards were fully implemented in the BC Building Code. So I'm on to slide three. We've had a number of industry challenges related to this standard and also the code as it relates to the NAF standard. So some issues that we've seen related to limited water ratings, glazed products that are not within the scope of NAF, such as curtain walls, slope glazing, and window walls. Site-built products has been a source of great confusion. And there's been some confusion about which products are required to conform to NAF and which are not. So there's a confusing reference to main entrance doors, for instance, that was interpreted by some people to be an exemption to NAF, or swing doors and garages. The question was, do they have to comply to NAF? So we're hoping to have answered a lot of these questions in these proposed code changes today. So with all that in mind, we've made some changes to the code to address the compliance and enforcement challenges and to clarify the application of the code and the reference standards. So these changes are not aimed at any specific segment of the industry, but are meant to address the challenges common to all fenestration products, whether they are made of wood, metal, vinyl, or fiberglass, and whether they are doors, windows, skylights, or some other type of glazed product. So on to slide 4, just a summary about what we'll be looking at here, changes to both Parts 5 and Part 9. Part 5, we're going to expand the scope to include other glazed products, such as curtain walls, clarify the intent that NAF or Part 5 is always an option, you get to choose, clarification that Part 4 calculations are acceptable when you're following the NAF standard, and an exclusion for fire-rated windows. On to slide 5, part 9, just a summary again. So NAF is only required where products are in scope of NAF. Other fenestration products will have to conform to part 5. So that's the big one there. No more site built in part 5. Clarification of application of section 9.6 for glass design. Deletion of the confusing performance expectations in 973. And clarification of how NAFs or how the code applies to other glazed products in Part 9 buildings. And I'm actually going to skip past slide 6. You can all read that. On to number 7. We'll just get into it. And basically what I'm going to do is walk through every single one of the changes in a little bit of detail and let you know why we've made these changes. So if you've come for an exciting slideshow, you're in the wrong place. So firstly, Division B, Part 1. Formerly this was, the section talks about climatic data, and formerly it said that everything under NAFS would have to use Table A1 in the Canadian Supplement. So this is no longer the case. The data in the Canadian Supplement will only be used for folks that are calculating the performance of their windows in accordance with the Canadian Supplement. And we're going to see later on that you don't actually have to do those calculations for Part 9 buildings anymore if you don't want to. Slide number 8. This is just a bit of housekeeping, so you'll see that we've updated a lot of the lists of reference standards and the references therein. So there's not much to worry about there. Sometimes the names have been updated. On to slide number 9. This is related to doors, windows, and skylights. Just is really just a reference update. Dwelling units shall conform to 9721. So just clarifying that you in a Part 3 building, you still need a door viewer or side light at every entrance. And you have to conform to the door security requirements, and we'll see a bit more on that later. On to slide number 10. There's a change here to allow the use of the ASTM E1300 standard as an alternative to CGSB 1220. So CGSB 1220 is currently the only design standard for glass that is referenced in the code. You now have another option. Slide number 11. So if you go into the ASTM E1300 standard, and I've just got a clip here of the scope statement at the beginning. It says, this practice applies to vertical and slope glazing in buildings for which the specified design loads consist of wind load, snow load, and self-weight with a total combined magnitude of... And I'm just going to skip over that. But the bottom line here is, at the end, it says, this practice shall not apply to other applications, including, but not limited to, balustrades and glass floor panels, structural glass members, and glass shelves. So the point being that the ASTM E1300 standard is not going to completely replace CGSB 1220. It is much more limited in scope and really is primarily for windows and doors. Moving on to slide number 12, we're going to get into some changes related to part 5. So first thing you'll notice is the title of subsection 510.2 has changed to include other glazed products. So that means things like curtain walls, window walls, or slope glazing. Right now, the way the code was written, because it specifically only referenced windows, doors, and skylights, and the requirement is to conform to NAF, which actually excludes these other glazed products, it was not clear what requirements actually had to be applied to things like curtain walls. So as you can see in sentence 1 and in the title above it, we've added a reference to other glazed products, and we'll see in a minute that Article 510.2.2 is going to clarify what requirements apply to those products. Sentence 2, there's no change there. It just tells us what a skylight is, includes those tubular daylighting devices as well. And lastly, at the bottom in sentence 3, we've actually exempted fenestration or doors that require a fire protection rating from the NAS standard and from the Canadian supplement. So they'll still have to conform to Part 5 to ensure that protection from wind and rain is dealt with. And just to confuse everyone, there's a link to an appendix note there that isn't actually in the appendix. So just to keep everyone on their toes, we've built in a little mistake there. My fault. Moving on to slide number 13. So 510.2.2, design and construction. This is already in the code, but we've moved everything right up front here to lay it out right up front that windows can either choose to conform to the reference subsections of Part 5 there, 514 and Section 5.3, 5.4, 5.6, or you can choose to conform to NAFS and the Canadian supplement. So this puts it right up front that this is a choice for products conforming to Part 5. So even if something is in scope of the NAF standard, you can still choose to use the Part 5 compliance path. So this means testing and labeling is not required for those products that choose the Part 5 compliance path. If you're choosing NAFs, you will have to test and label. Part 5 does not require the testing and labeling, but it is generally going to involve professional design, although that's not a requirement of the code. So this is nothing new. It was the intent of the original 2012 code requirements, which were based on the 2010 National Building Code requirements, from what I understand. The intent was being widely misinterpreted to require any and all windows, doors, and skylights to be NAFS tested and labeled. And again, my understanding was that was not the intent. So these minor adjustments to the language are meant to more accurately reflect the original intent of those code requirements in Part 5. And again, there's a new appendix note here. This time it actually does exist in the appendix, and this was adopted from the National Building Code relating to field testing. I'm not going to go into that in detail. It just provides some guidance for field testing fenestration products that are not tested in the laboratory to NAFS. And, of course, they are not. The field testing is not a requirement of the code since it's just an appendix note. So I'm on to slide 14. So as I mentioned before, Part 5 now clearly includes other glazed products and clarifies that, as shown in sentence 2 above, they have to conform to subsection 514, section 5.4, section 5.3, and section 5.6. So that's just like any other environmental separator in Part 5. So So as most of you are probably aware, when you use Canadian Supplement to select the appropriate fenestration for your geographic location, you'll have to calculate the specified DRWP, the driving rain wind pressure, and the specified wind load. So the specified wind load calculation is going to give you that PG rating, or performance grade, of the fenestration product. The Canadian Supplement contains within it all the calculations to derive that PG rating, but it's really just a simplified version of what calculations you can do under the code, so through a combination of parts 4 and 5. So many people are starting to become aware that these calculations under NAFS will typically give you a more conservative value than using the wind and rain loads derived from the code. So the net effect of those conservative calculations is that certain products were requiring higher than necessary wind and water resistance, which can significantly affect the cost of the products. In recognition of this, sentence 2 above, there is now a specific permission for the BC Building Code's wind and water loads from section 5.2 to be used when you're complying with NAFS. So this section is going to point you back to part 4 of the code for calculation of your wind loads. Because the Canadian Supplement doesn't provide a specific, because the code doesn't provide a specific calculation for a specified DRWP, you're still going to use the calculations in NAFS for that. And then we're going to see later on that we have some similar changes for Part 9 buildings as well that reflect these changes to Part 5. So I'm on.
Are we going to take a break now?
To slide 15, we'll do a break for questions, I think, in just a couple, or one more slide, I think it is, yeah. So some new appendix notes here. You'll just see that the appendix note, firstly, is clarifying the two compliance paths, and the main point here being that you always get to choose between NAFS and Part 5 if you are building a complex building or a Part 3 building. It's the option of the owner or designer to either comply with Part 5 for the selection of windows, doors, and skylights, or to do that according to NAFS and the Canadian Supplement. And then as we discussed, other glazed products, those are things that can't meet NAFS. So you'll see if you open up the NAFS standard that it has a specific scope, and it specifically includes things like curtain walls. We're just making it crystal clear here that those types of products will have to go to the other parts of Part 5 for compliance. They're not expected, nor can they comply with NAFS. Again, if you're really paying attention, you'll notice that there's a new reference in here to Section 5.3. It used to just say subsection 514. 5.4 and 5.6, we've added 5.3. This was actually already there as a secondary reference, and we've just put it up front just to make it a little more obvious. Previously, if you went to Section 5.1.4, that would then point you to Section 5.2, which then in turn would point you to 5.3. So it was a little bit convoluted. Again, we've just made it a little more clear. And then thirdly, there's a note here clarifying an issue that we've seen a lot of, and that is when you use Part 5 to specify a NAFS window, you can actually end up with a lower PG rating or design pressure than if you use the NAFS standard. So that's an important one for folks to be aware of. So maybe we'll pause here for a few questions related to Part 5.
Okay, that concludes the discussion of the first part of the NAFS changes related to Part 5. Please type your questions either into the link comments field on the left side of your screen or email them to building.safety@gov.bc.ca. Our first question related immediately to what you were just talking about, Junie. How were the new PG ratings arrived at for the various municipalities that have been produced by the standards branch, especially for districts beside the ocean?
Basically, the process was done using Part 5 of the code. So if we're going to get to that a little bit later, because those tables are exclusively for Part 9 buildings. So that's the new table that some people have seen. It's called Table C4. It's in Division C of the code. And again, it relates only to Part 9 buildings, and they have to be less than 10 meters in height. And if you're using, if you're designing a Part 9 building, you can use that table for selection of your windows, doors, and skylights. Windows and doors, not skylights. And the calculations were derived in accordance with Part 5 of the code, and they actually represent open terrain values for Part 9 buildings. And so that does reflect those properties or those locations that are on the waterfront. You will notice that the numbers are about 30% lower than they used to be. So what used to be a rough terrain value is now actually an open terrain value. That's an approximate equivalent across the board. But we're confident that that these numbers are appropriate because they are based on Part 5 design. So, again, the real issue was that the NAF standard, through the simplified calculations, was actually over-specifying windows. And we may see some changes to the NAF standard in the future to reflect that as well.
The next question, when will the online calculator reflect these changes?
Good question. We don't deal with the online calculators, so those are done by several different companies. So it would just be up to those individual companies to update their calculators. Really, what this does, though, is this new table C4 in terms of Part 9 buildings. It really makes it so you don't need to use those calculators. And one of the issues we were finding is that a lot of people were using those calculators. And depending on what weather data they had selected, you could end up with slightly different values from the three different most popular calculators that were online. So again, those calculators are still good for Part 5 buildings, although they should be used with caution. For Part 9 buildings, you can go straight to the table in C4, and we'll go through that later.
Our next question, how would a window and door manufacturer guarantee their product satisfy Part 5 requirements without NAF's testing?
I don't know about the word guarantee, but basically a manufacturer has the two options. They have the option of NAF's testing, which is, I guess, a good option because you do verify in the test lab that performance of that window. The other option is through Part 5, which, again, doesn't necessarily require the use of an engineer, but typically that's what we see. Is an engineer signing off on that part of the building envelope specifically and being responsible for the design.
Our next question, are the changes that took effect December 11th retroactive to projects with permits pulled prior to that date?
The answer is a simple no. The minister's orders that we typically do will have an effective date, and that effective date applies to permits applied for on or after that date. So any existing building permits will be subject to the old rules, but you might see a willingness by some local authorities to move to the newer requirements knowing that they do exist. So you'll have to speak to your individual municipality about the opportunity to be able to use that. Technically speaking, it does not apply retroactively.
Okay, our next question, will the letters of assurance be updated to identify when a registered professional chooses the Part 5 compliance path rather than NAF?
We have had no talk about that at this point. So if there's a suggestion being made, I guess perhaps we can take that up offline, and I'll be providing my contact information towards the end of the presentation. Maybe we can talk a bit more about that.
Okay, our next question, and perhaps our last one before going back to the presentation. In some cases, We've heard the use of third-party engineers to supply a stamp letter confirming the structural PG of a site-built door, including bifolds, multi-slides, and lift slides. In others, no letter was supplied, but the local inspector confirmed that the site-built path would be approved. Have these paths been blocked with these upcoming revisions?
The paths haven't been blocked. I think, if anything, these paths are more clear now. So if you have a product that, let's say you're designing a Part 9 building, and you have a product that doesn't fit within the scope of NAFS, you're going to have to go to Part 5 for the design of that. Now, as I said before, that does not require an engineer necessarily under the code. You may find that your local authority has some related requirements for professionals, and they do have certain authorities to require them. But in terms of the building code itself, it does not require a professional for Part 5 design. For Part 9 building, that means letters of assurance are not applicable to door, window, and skylight design for a Part 9 building. If you're in Part 5, again, the path is going to be this other glazed products path that we discussed. And so, again, it's going to be much clearer now that you have to conform with the rest of Part 5. And if it is in a Part 3 building, you're likely to see a professional involved signing off on Part 5 design, which will, of course, include the selection of windows, doors, and skylights.
Okay, that's not the end of questions on these topics. We're going to move on to the part of the presentation relating to Part 9, but questions at the end of this section of the webinar can apply to either the Part 9 or Part 5 section. So, Junichi, do you want to pick it up again?
Sounds good. Thanks, John. So we're back at slide number 17, and we're going to jump into Part 9. So first we get to section 9.6, and this is a section that applies to glass. The language here was confusing, as it seemed to exclude exterior windows, doors, and skylights from the scope of section 9.6. And yet clause B, the protection of glass, seemed to be all-inclusive. So there was quite a bit of confusion as to what section 9.6 did and did not cover. So we've changed that around, and it's specifically now section 9.6 applies to all doors, windows, and skylights, and you'll see there's an appendix note that clarifies that means both interior and exterior doors. So we're also aware that the requirement that follows requires glass to be designed in accordance with the CGSB Glass Design Standard 12.20, was meant to be applied to glass in all windows, including NAFS windows. And there was actually a reference in NAFS to the CGSB 1220 standard, although it was a very loose reference. It did not absolutely require compliance. It said it was required where required by the code, the applicable code. So this actually makes it clear now that a NAFS window must conform with the CGSB 1220 design standard, and we'll see again that we're going to have the option of ASTM as well. We'll get to that in a slide or two. So again, there's a simple change here along with the appendix note making it clear that section 9.6 applies to NAFS windows, as well as the other items listed. One thing we did not resolve with this series of code changes is all the talk about clause E there, glazed panels and partitions. There is an appeal that went through recently through the Building Code Appeal Board related to that. They had actually gone back to the National Building Code folks to confirm that glazed panels and partitions was not meant to include glass guards. We have not had the chance to examine that issue in detail, so we're sticking with status quo on that for now, that guards are dealt with exclusively by Section 9.8, I believe it is, and no requirement for CGSB 1220 for Part 9 guards. Moving on to slide number 18. So here's where we see the requirement to conform to the CGSB glass design standard. There was some confusion about the table shown here and whether it was meant to further limit the size of the glass that was designed to that standard. We understand that was not the intent, but it was intended as an alternative to using the standard. So we made that very clear by noting that the table for glass design, for maximum glass sizes, is an exception to using the glass design standard. So you see that language in sentence one. And again, ASTM E1300 is going to be an option for glass design as well. And we saw earlier that that is a standard that is fairly limited in scope, primarily to use in windows, doors, and skylights. And sorry, I misspoke. The reference to the table is actually in the sentence two, not sentence one, as I mentioned. So I'm going to move on to slide number 19. And we're going to move on to section 9.7, and this is where we start to see some pretty big changes. And I've got the appendix notes up right now, but what you'll notice is that the title of this section is still called Windows, Doors, and Skylights. So we have not added a reference to other glazed panels or products like we did in Part 5. This is because Part 9 of the code is really intended for simple cookie-cutter type buildings that use typical manufactured fenestration. So things like curtain walls or window walls really are outside of this typical cookie-cutter type approach of Part 9. And we see that in other areas of the code. For instance, 923, if you've got large spans, you end up getting kicked to Part 4, as an example. So the bottom line is other glazed products that were sometimes mistakenly being accepted as a site-built solution will now have to conform to Part 5. So the new appendix note there talks about this, site-built windows specifically. They now have to conform to Part 5. It also notes that there is a choice of compliance paths for manufactured windows. So again, same as in Part 5, you can either choose NAFS or Part 5. There's always that choice to do either. And this was written in the code previously, but the language was a source of some confusion, and those choices weren't necessarily clear to people. So I'm also going to take a minute here to talk about the former section 975, or subsection I should say, site-built windows, doors, and skylights. So that is now deleted. There is no longer any reference to site-built products in 9.7, although we will see that there still is in the energy provisions in 936. We'll talk about that later. This is one of the most confusing and misinterpreted parts of Section 9.7. So a site-built window is not defined in the code, but it is defined in NAFS as being something outside of the scope of NAFS and that is intended for assembly on the building site and made up of parts from supplied from different manufacturers. So these doors, windows and skylights, are not what a lot of people were calling custom doors. They're not manufactured or artisan wood doors. They're actually products that are either site assembled or site glazed. So those ones are going to have to go to Part 5. So yeah, some people were using site built as sort of a loophole to avoid NAFS testing and compliance, but that was never the intent. Again, the intent was for truly site manufactured products. And because those products are somewhat outside of the scope of the cookie cutter scope of Part 9, we've moved them into Part 5. So I'm on to slide number 20. Just a definition here of doors and what we mean when we're referring to the term doors, which you would think is fairly obvious, but what this does actually is excludes vehicular access doors. So there was a lot of confusion about, in particular, heated garages and whether or not that garage door, the vehicle door, had to conform to NAFS. Of course it couldn't. Vehicle doors are outside of the scope of NAFS, but they were arguably within the scope of the code. So this actually just clarifies that if you have a garage door whether the garage is heated or unheated, you don't have to, it's not expected that that garage door be compliant with the NAF standard or Part 5. We will see, though, that you still have to meet the U-value requirements for energy in Section 936 for that garage door. So it's going to be an insulated garage door, regardless. If it's a conditioned garage. So 9722, this whole section was basically deleted. It was a series of cross-references to other parts of the code where doors were dealt with. We consider that redundant. It's not necessary to repeat the different requirements that apply to doors in different places. The concept or the principle of the code is that you have to comply with every part of it unless it's otherwise shown or otherwise explained to you. So it's not necessary, again, to repeat those requirements in different places. They, of course, all still apply. So slide number 21. This was formerly titled Performance Expectations, and again, this entire section is deleted. So this was another section that caused quite a bit of confusion because it seemed to be requiring different levels of window performance for different products. So an example was that main entrance doors reference where people thought that meant that the main entrance door was actually exempt from NAFs or from the rain loads or whatever. So all that is now gone. If people want to use a performance type path for selection of their doors and windows, then the option of alternative solutions is always there. So there wasn't a need to add an additional performance path, here. I'm on to slide number 22. This is already here, essentially. So something that is required to be fire rated. A fire rated window does not require the thermal break, so that's unchanged. And then we'll see later on that there's a larger exemption for fire-rated windows. In fact, I think it's in the next slide, so we'll move on to that one. Subsection 974, lots of changes here. So again, we've moved the compliance options right to the front. You can either choose to conform to Article 9742, which is going to tell you go to NAFs and the Canadian Supplement, or you can choose to go to Part 5. So again, if you choose the Part 5 path, even though you're in a Part 9 building, you will not be expected to test and label the windows. But again, typically that will involve the use of an engineer, although that's not required by the code. And then as I mentioned before, you'll see in sentence 2, if a window is required to be fire rated, have a fire protection rating, then it's not required to conform to NAFs. On to the next slide. So we've just got an appendix note here, clarifies what we talked about before, what is and what is not expected to comply to NAFs. We don't need to worry about garage doors anymore in terms of compliance with NAFs or compliance with Part 5. And I'm on to slide number 25. So Article 9742, this is where we reference NAFs and the Canadian Supplement. You can see in sentence 1, there are now some exceptions to compliance with NAFs and the Canadian Supplement, so we'll get to that in a sec. Just going to move on to the next slide, number 26. And here are those exceptions that we're talking about. So NAFs has a path for rating doors, swing doors, as being limited water rated, and this basically means that they have not withstood the pressure, the water resistance test at the specified pressure for that door. So at any lower level, even down to zero. NAF, the standard itself, spoke about limited water doors a little bit and suggested that they could be used in accessible locations, but that was only a suggestion in an appendix, and if you're reading the code, it wasn't clear where you could or could not use these limited water type of swing doors. So this code change now specifically tells you that you can use that limited water rated door between your dwelling and your garage or carport. And it also tells you that you can use it in a location that is designed to be accessible. So that's clause B there. We're referring to Article 33113. You'll see there that there are a number of provisions for accessible buildings, and you'll have to meet those in order to use the limited water door. Or you can also install one of these limited doors in a location that is not required to have a head flashing installed in accordance with Section 927. So that's the cladding section. There's a specific sentence reference there where you can determine, based on your overhang, whether or not you require a head flashing. Basically, the point of that requirement is to determine whether or not your door is exposed. There's some criticism that the system is imperfect, but it's a very simple way to determine whether or not whether you require a head flashing and hence whether or not you're in an exposed location. So if you are in a low exposure location that doesn't need a head flashing, then you can use a limited water rated door. So again, there's going to be a sentence three as well, and it's not shown on this slide, but clarifies that fire-rated doors and windows do not require NAF testing. So they're outside of the scope of this section. Okay, so I'm on slide 27. We're on to window, door, and skylight selection. So we have had a lot of issues here. As we talked about a bit earlier, the Canadian supplement provided some calculations for selection of your window, door, and skylight, some calculations that were quite conservative and were resulting in quite high values to the point that we had manufacturers were experiencing issues with testing and product availability. Certain types of products weren't able to pass the very high ratings that were required, and so we were seeing a lot of restrictions happening in the market. And as we discovered that this was really unjustified, so those numbers have been reduced, and we'll get to that table in a minute. Skylights will still be selected in accordance with the Canadian supplement. So again, the table that we have provided does not include selection of skylights. And then, again, if you do still choose to use that NAF's calculation method, and this is clarified here in the appendix notes, if you do still choose to use the NAF's Canadian supplement to select your windows, doors, and skylights, you're going to be using the weather data from the NAF standard from Table A1 of that standard. And this is because it provides a different DRWP value than the code does. It provides a value that's not actually referenced in the code. And on slide 28, just another appendix note about that. And I'll move on to slide 29. So this is kind of the big one for part 9. It's a new table in Division C, Table C4, required performance of windows and doors in part 9 buildings. So here you're going to go and just read off the table and get your performance grade and your water resistance rating that is required for that door or window for that geographic location. So no more calculations, no more calculators online, no more open versus rough terrain arguments. It's all right here as one clear minimum standard. So again, you'll see the performance levels are lower. They're approximately 30%. Lower than what was previously required. These numbers are new open terrain values, so they're very defensible values based on Part 5 calculations. So Part 5 calculations are going to account for the height and the location and the exposure of these windows specifically. And because we're defaulting to the open terrain values, it is going to account for things on the shoreline, windows and doors installed on a shoreline. And again, so they're right in line with Part 5 of the code. It's a safe level of performance to require without being excessive, as it formerly was accused of being. And as I mentioned before, we might see some changes to the NAF Canadian supplement in the future that would reflect that and bring other parts of the country into alignment with these changes. I'm going to move on to slide number 30. Section 975, this is, was formerly the site built section. It's all still there, and it actually all still looks mostly the same, but it's not about site built windows and doors anymore. It's just about the security requirements and for windows, doors, and skylights. So these requirements are essentially the same as in the previous code, so they should be familiar to most manufacturers and building officials. And just as before, they apply to all exterior fenestration products. So some accommodation has been made within these sections to prevent duplication because NAFS itself also has some security requirements. So these new security requirements align with NAFS as well. So you'll see there's a reference at the bottom there to the ASTM test, for instance, and that's the same one that's referenced in NAFS. And on to slide number 31, so more on swing doors here. And again, these are some longstanding requirements for swing doors that were in previous codes. There was some concern when I presented this at the pre-public review webinar we had a few months ago about some of these restrictions in this article. For instance, the total panel area of a rail and style door, that was one that came up quite a bit. It's important to note that those restrictions only exist if you don't conform to the AMA 1304 forced entry standard, and that's the standard that you're going to have to conform to anyway to meet NAFS. So if you've gone through the NAFS testing process, you basically can disregard this section because you're going to have to have passed AMA 1304. You will have dealt with your security requirements. If you're going through the Part 5 path, you're going to have to come back here and make sure that you have conformed with the security requirements for your Part 9 building. On to slide number 32. So just a really minor change here on manufacturer's instructions. Sentence 1 is more or less the same, but it's now clarified in sentence 2 that if there is a conflict between the instructions provided by the manufacturer and the requirements of the code, then of course the code shall govern in those cases. And that wasn't clear before. So slide number 33. We're on past the doors and windows stuff, basically.
Do you want to take a break now and have some questions on the...
Yeah, sorry, I just lost my way a little bit there. Yeah, why don't we take a little break there and get a few questions.
Okay, and just to clarify for people, we will be having some discussions before the end of this webinar on proposed changes to window requirements in 936, as well as the main sort of NAFS focus of this conversation as well. So please don't leave before that, but we will now take some questions in relation to the Part 5 and Part 9 NAFTA discussion. First question, are accessible doors exempt from NAFTA?
So what we saw there in Part 9 changes is that we've specifically allowed the use of a limited water rated swing door in an accessible location. So accessible doors are not exempt from NAFTA, and that's been part of the issue is that people don't, there's a very limited number of doors, if any, that are accessible that can comply completely with NAFTA, especially in an area with a higher rain load. So what this effectively does is allows you to reduce the rain load, the design for the rain load, in an accessible location. But it's not an out completely. You have to make sure that you're actually providing the proper floor space and door swing space for that area to be accessible. And that's why we've referenced those accessibility requirements in Part 3, just for that relaxation. So again, you'll be able to use a limited water rated swing door in an accessible location.
All right, next question. With the removable or the removal of the glass tables in the appendix for Section 9.6, how will a manufacturer provide compliance with glass strength requirements in Section 9.6?
So if I'm not mistaken, those tables were related to site-built doors and windows. So you'll, as a manufacturer, you've always been expected to comply with the CGSB 1220 standard, and so that will continue to be the case. Those glass tables were based on CGSB 1220, so they were pared down or simplified versions of what you get out of CGSB 1220. And again, we've also opened that up so the ASTM E1300 option is available because that is a standard that's being a little bit more widely used these days, to my understanding.
So these tables were an alternative to 1220, was that the question?
I believe so. I'm just operating off memory here. I don't have a copy of the code in front of me, but I believe that those tables specifically were for site-built, and I believe they're based off of CGSB 1220 standard.
Okay, next question. Can you clarify again the requirement for letters of assurance when using Part 5 or Part 9 windows or doors? If no letters of assurance is needed, how else can you get a confirmation of the performance to meet Part 5?
Sorry, that was for a Part 9 building?
Well, the question doesn't make that clear.
That's fine.
You can use, it says, when using Part 5, in Part 9 windows or doors, so, yeah.
Right, so the scope of the letters of assurance currently does not include a Part 5 component, right? So if you go to Division C of your code, I think it's subsection 227, specifically tells you where the letters of assurance would apply in a Part 9 building. So that's shared egress and or situations where you have Part 4 structural components, but does not include any reference to Part 5. So the letters of assurance are not the appropriate tool to use. If a professional is involved in the design, then you're going to be using something other than the letters of assurance to confirm conformance. So that really is more or less up to the authority having jurisdiction. They may have some requirements in bylaw that specify the use of a professional, but it's really the same situation as we've always had for components that are engineered in a Part 9 building, in that the Buildings and Other Structures Regulation under the Local Government Act, or sorry, under the Community Charter, has always specified that the letters of assurance shall not be used for purposes other than those described in the building code. So, again, if an authority wants to require some other form of assurance through a different authority in their in law, then they're free to do so, but they just can't use the letters of assurance.
And we are certainly unaware of any circumstance where local governments have attempted to do that. With the text changes in section 9.7, will there be PDF pages that people can download to substitute into their code binder? In other words, the quick and easy change to your code binder.
Right. So this is a long-standing issue. Unfortunately, it's somewhat beyond our control at the moment. The replacement pages are dealt with by the Queen's printer. We're working on, of course, we work with them on these pages to proof them and make sure they're accurate, but we're currently working on a replacement package that goes up to and including revision 7 of the code. So that does include these changes. There is now a revision 8 that has been posted to our website with a few changes. So the replacement pages will not include those. We'll get to work on those as soon as we can. We're hoping that the next set of replacement pages, I think they just released the plumbing ones last week, and we're hoping the building ones will come out in the first part of the new year.
Next question. Site-built products also need to be considered to include large door systems such as bifold, lift slide, and multi-slide doors that may be too large to be able to transport by a truck when fully assembled. So how do you handle those?
Well, so there is no site-built products path anymore, so those products, if they're impractical or impossible to test under the NAF standards, and they're going to be site-glazed or site-assembled, then those are Part 5 products. One thing I failed to mention in my last response is that the online code is always, well, not always, but is kept as up-to-date as possible. So the online code as of last week is 100% up to date with all the revisions, including the latest revision number 8.
Next question, and hopefully I'm getting the intent of the writer of the question correct here. They've asked about their waterfront, and they say, if my PA is only 260, I don't have to apply the 400 PA that used to be there. Is that correct?
Sorry, can you repeat it?
If my PA is only 260, I don't have to apply the 400 PA that used to be in the code. Or in
It used to be in the Canadian supplement, or used to be calculated in accordance with the Canadian supplement. So really, that 400 that you're referring to, and I'm not sure what climatic area you're in or geographic area you're in, but that 400 PA would have been derived using the calculations in the Canadian supplement. So if you're seeing a value of 260 on our new table C4 and you're dealing with a Part 9 building, that is your new minimum standard, 260 PA.
Okay, next question. If an entry roof covers any entry door so that no head flashing is required, then the entry door may be LW standard? Question mark.
Yeah, that's correct. If no head flashing is required in 927, and I think that's a 4-to-1 overhang ratio, then you're permitted to use an LW swing door.
Okay.
If you were using a sliding door as the entry door in that location, there would be no relaxation or exemption because sliding doors do not get rated to limited water.
Next question, under 92738. We assume that a door is considered protected as long as the flashing or covering element is at least as wide as the door. In other words, no extension in width is required. The 1-to-4 calculation is only ever measured vertically and horizontally in section. Is that correct?
I believe that's correct. I'm thinking, I'm not sure about the second part of the question there. I have to think about it a bit more, but the first part of the question, that the overhang isn't required in the horizontal direction, that's true. I mean, it doesn't specify that in the code. It simply provides a length of the overhang, and it doesn't specify how far that has to go in either direction from the top of the door. So that's why I mentioned that the system has been accused of being imperfect, but we don't see any large health or safety issues at this point arising from that relaxation.
This revisits actually a question I think we had earlier to some extent. How does a window manufacturer confirm compliance with Part 5 if they do not use NAPS?
Yeah, again, so you're relying on your designer. So if you're hiring, or if you have a staff designer, or if you're hiring a designer to design your fenestration products in accordance with Part 5, you're going to want to be satisfied that that person is an appropriate person to be designing that product. So again, with Part 5 of the code specifically, it doesn't say you have to be an engineer, in particular if you're in a Part 9 building, but what you're probably going to see is that, you know, those folks that are familiar with Part 5 design are probably going to be engineers.
Next question, what ratings are required for entrance doors in a dwelling unit under Part 9?
So the big change there is we've dropped any reference to entrance doors in terms of having specific performance requirements for wind and water penetration. That was just really a source of confusion. They're not actually subject to any different requirements than any other doors or windows. So if you're in a Part 9 building, you're going to follow Table C4. You're going to get your PG rating as your design pressure or PG rating, and you're going to get your water rating from that Table C4. If you happen to have that door installed in an accessible location, or if it's a protected location, as we discussed earlier, that doesn't require head flashing in accordance with Section 927 of the code, then you're going to be permitted to use a limited water door that is tested for a lower water pressure rating.
Next question. Actually, somebody has noted here that AIBC and APEG use schedules SB and SC to allow third-party engineers to provide professional assurance of design and field review for exterior glazing systems. So I think that's more piece of information.
Yeah, that's actually a really helpful piece of information, because I think that answers a couple of previous questions, is that at least in the province of BC, professional architects and engineers are going to use their own schedules rather than the code schedules, but there are some documents in place to help with professional assurance.
Next question, 97431 references a building no more than 10 meters in height. Can the performance grade for a window or door installed lower than 10 meters be used in a building greater than 10 meters with the higher windows and doors performance grade determined by the Canadian supplement?
Yeah, so that restriction is specifically for Table C4. If you're using Table C4, your building will have to be less than 10 meters in height. This makes perfect sense because we are dealing with Part 9 buildings, so they're limited to 3 stories in height. If you do have a higher building and you go to the Canadian supplement, you will see that the calculations can be done for all types of buildings up to, I'm not sure how high it goes, but basically for just about any height. And that's because those calculations do accommodate both small and large buildings. So I guess bottom line to that question is if you, for whatever reason, had a Part 9 building that ended up being over 10 meters, and I'm not sure why that would be, it'd be very unusual, but you could design those windows and doors in accordance with the Canadian supplement calculations.
Next question, actually a follow-up to a question a little bit earlier, and I'm not sure if it's a comment or just a further question, but in relation to 927383 for flashing over the door, refers to the vertical distance over the trim and not the door itself. Any issue with this method of measuring to determine if an LW door is applicable?
I'm not sure quite what the question is there, but I mean, basically we're looking right in 927.38 at those specifications. I believe, from what I recall, it just gives you that overhang ratio of 4-1, so you're looking at the height above the door versus the distance of the overhang, and that has to be a minimum of 4-1. Are there any issues with that? You know, I think I said earlier that some people have said there are some issues with that. It's not a perfect system. But again, we are not hearing of health and safety issues related to that. So if there are any, I'd certainly be willing to listen. But again, we have not heard of any great health and safety issues related to the enforcement of that requirement.
Next question. This is regard to limited water designation for doors, 972. Setting the criteria based not whether or not a head flashing is required to define if limited water designation doesn't seem to be a robust door option. A 3-foot overhang over the door provides a condition that doesn't require a head flashing, but the bottom of the door will be wet. Has this situation been considered with this change? It's the bottom of the door where most of the wetting will take place and create problems.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been considered. Again, so the same response is that we're not seeing a large amount of health and safety issues as a result of the enforcement of 927. I think one of the most important things to remember here is that the code is coming at this issue from a minimum health and safety perspective, because that's what the building code is. It's a document that regulates the minimum health and safety of buildings. So a small amount of water at the sill level is not likely to be a problem. A large amount of water could create problems. It could create, you know, even create structural problems if there was mold growth and the water was spreading. But again, we're not seeing those types of issues. We're not hearing of those types of issues. So it's not a concern, a health and safety concern for us at this point. From a window manufacturer's perspective or a door manufacturer's perspective, it may be a concern to them because they may have the expectation, or their customers may have the expectation, that not a drop of water is going to get past that door seal. Again, that's a different consideration or a different viewpoint than the building code is coming at it from. So window and door manufacturers are free to specify above these levels if they think that is appropriate, but that's their right as a manufacturer or a specifier. But the minimum is what we're printing in the code.
Next question, and finally one that I can answer fairly easily. When do these code changes take effect? And it was December 11th, 2015, and we've had a little bit of a discussion about perhaps local government using discretion on backdating some of those issues. Next question after that. Are the PG ratings in Table C4 required to be used by the municipalities indicated?
By the municipalities indicated. So it's an interesting question, and I think I know the angle it's coming from is if we go back to the beginning of the code, it tells us that the authority having jurisdiction is permitted to determine their own weather data. And so that provision still has not changed. So we have certain locations, for instance, in the Greater Victoria area that either are listed or are not listed in those tables, and they choose to use different weather data for whatever reason. That practice can certainly continue. We've made no changes in that regard. But I think what you'll find is that the bottom line is that weather data is now at a much more manageable level throughout the province. So what we were seeing before was some places were adopting another location's climate data, and that was resulting in some very high PG ratings or very high water ratings that were difficult for people to live with and pay for. Because all the levels have dropped by about 30%, I don't think you're going to be seeing those same issues.
A somewhat related question, how do we get PG for locations not included in the list of communities?
Yeah, that's an unfortunate problem that we don't have a solution for. So again, the authority having jurisdiction still has the ability to set or adopt somebody else's weather data if they think it's appropriate. So that's one approach a lot of communities will use. It's just the reality of the code. We can't list every single location throughout the province, so we have as many as we can. Those places that are not listed, you'll have to go to that authority specifically to find out if they're using another community's listed data or if they have their own set of data. Even if they have their own data, they likely will not have their own PG ratings and water ratings calculated, so you would have to do that in accordance with NAF still. But again, if they're adopting somebody else's weather data, then you could use the table C4.
Okay, I think we'll wrap up our discussion of the NAF stuff now, part 9 and part 5, bearing in mind that additional questions that people are certainly welcome to continue to feed to us to building.safety@govbcca or by some other means, and we will continue to be following up with answers to those questions. We do have an additional topic, though, that we would like to tag on to the end of this webinar, and that's in relation to proposed 936 changes for DORS, and here to present that is Adrian Mohara.
Thank you very much for the intro, John. I want to thank everyone. I do want to let you know that if you have the PDF version of the slides, these slides are not in that section, so we will make them available in the webinar afterwards, I believe. They will be available in the webinar afterwards. I'll just go through some of the proposed changes that we've made for DORS and the energy efficiency requirements. As you know, Section 936 on energy efficiency was announced in April 2013 and made effective in December 2014. It provided two compliance paths on energy efficiency, the prescriptive path that's outlined in subsections 936.2 to 936.4, and the energy performance compliance path, which can be demonstrated through energy modeling, as outlined in subsection 936.5. So for DORS, the prescriptive thermal performance requirements are laid out in Article 936.27, which outlines that DORS must have an overall thermal transmittance, or USI value, of 1.4 in climate zone 7B and 8, 1.6 in climate zones 6 and 7A, and 1.8 in climate zones 4 and 5. Climate zones 4 and 5 cover a good portion of the province's populations. Section 936 did provide an allowance for one DOR that need not perform as well as the general requirements in Table 936.27A. That allowance was to have a USI value of up to 2.6 watts per square meter per degree Kelvin. This allowance is factored in the calculations aimed at maintaining an overall energy performance of the building. So for the next slide, slide 34, do I have the ability to go down slides? Some door manufacturers discovered that their products didn't meet the new general requirements for DORS, but that the USI 2.6 watts per square meter per degree Kelvin value was very generous. So Building and Safety Standards Branch undertook an energy modeling exercise using the house archetypes from the modeling that was undertaken by the National Code Center to develop Section 936. And adapted them to model energy use of buildings with different door configurations and to determine the potential for distributing the allowance, that 2.6 allowance, and trade-offs. So BSSB has proposed a change to the building code. And keep in mind, it's proposed. We anticipate it to be effective in the near future to distribute this USI allowance of 2.6 amongst other doors. Okay, so the proposed new door requirements allow for are shifting the 2.6 allowance amongst three doors in climate zones 4 and 5 to have three doors at a USI value of 2.1. You're allowed a fourth door if you increase the attic insulation to compensate for the extra heat loss at USI 2.1. Or you can continue to use the existing prescriptive values of all doors at 1.8 with one door at 2.6. In climate zone 6 and 7A, it's 2.1 for two doors with a third for with a third at 2.1, provided you add the attic insulation above the minimum for climate zone 6 and 7A of R5 or RSI of 0.88. In climate zone 7B and 8, you are allowed $2 at USI value of 2.0 watts per square meter per degree Kelvin. And computer energy modeling software has validated that this approach will not have a significant overall impact on the energy efficiency of the building. It provides a second compliance path. Says that it may not, the slide did not switch, sorry. I switched on mine, but I don't. Oh, I'll take over as presenter, maybe that. Does that work? I think it should be okay now for everyone. My apologies. So this new option would be available for doors of any material. So this would provide a second prescriptive compliance path, offering another option in addition to the standard one door allowance and the whole building energy modeling compliance paths for doors in the marketplace. And this option would be available for doors of any material. And keep in mind that the province is continuing to discuss climate action initiatives that may result in setting higher energy efficiency standards, and this would create an imperative for industry to address the energy performance of their product to meet future energy and greenhouse gas emission reduction targets. Thank you. Do you have any questions?
I'm not seeing any questions come in, and maybe it's a little premature, and maybe people just want to digest this information. I will tell you that if and when, as we expect, that these changes are enacted in the fairly near future with a fairly short effective date. I think that was the intention, that we will certainly let you know as soon as possible. And if you have any further questions on this matter, perhaps not today, but we can hear those if you can send them to our building code website or building code email address, rather, and we will follow up in the fullness of time. Well, how to provide feedback? Will there be an official public consultation process for this? I believe public consultation has already taken place on this matter, and we're very close to conclusion. Junie, do you have any?
Is the question specific to the changes about wood doors, or is it about the NAFTA changes? Wood doors, there was a targeted consultation that took place to help propose these changes, and that involved a number of manufacturers of doors. For the NAFTA stuff, we had a large-scale public consultation already, and that process is closed.
All right. I see a question regarding energy efficiency requirements for windows. There will be no allowable trade-off for use of lower energy performance windows. The trade-off was only undertaken for doors because there was already the existing allowance, so there was room to balance out the two. The public consultation on proposed 936 changes, we did that directly, we did that with the industry this fall. Werner again asking if the builder can use higher insulation of the walls or better HVAC systems. We felt that we can discuss that offline, I guess, the rationale for our choice of using the attic insulation.
So let's wrap that up for now. We have another webinar coming up on other recently enacted changes to 936 and 932, I believe, coming up in just about 9 minutes from now. So I'm John Nicol. Thank you for joining us for this webinar. We're going to take a break in a few minutes. Remember to look for this webinar on our website, www.housing.gov.bc.ca/building. And if you would like a certificate of attendance to this or the next one, just email us your name and company name, as many of you have already done, I see, to building.safety@gov.bc.ca. And we will email the certificate back to you. Remember, licensed residential builders or nominees of residential builders can count this for professional development credit. Thank you for your time, everybody. Talk to you soon.
And I just want to add one more thing at the end here. Those of you that are concerned with the 9613 glass tables and the removal of those from the appendix, my information is up there right now. It's junichi.jensen, so junichi.jensen@gov.bc.ca. If those folks that are concerned with that want to email me in the next little while, we went back and forth so much on a lot of these different changes, and I'm actually wondering if there is an error there. So let me follow up with you folks individually. So again, junichi.jensen@gov.bc.ca. Send me an email if you're concerned about that. Hi, folks. If you're going to be joining us for the second part or the second webinar, you can either call back in or just stay on the line for a few minutes. Thanks. Hi, folks. We're just going to get started in a couple more minutes here.
Hello and welcome. My name is John Nicola with Building and Safety Standards Branch. I'll be your moderator for this discussion of other changes approved for implementation starting December 11th, 2015. And once again, I'm going to start with a few housekeeping items for those who might not have been at the beginning of the previous webinar. We understand somewhat over 500 people with us today, which is why some of you will be following along in link, and others may be just on the phone following the PowerPoint that you will have received by email. You all received an email with the presentation slides, which you're welcome to open and follow along in case your connection to link gets dropped. Presentation divided into two parts. We'll be having a question and answer period in between the two sections. And with so many people participating in two different ways, there's obviously little possibility we'll be able to answer all the questions that you have today, but we will get around to that eventually. You will be submitting them, hopefully, on either the link conversation box or by email to building.safety@gov.bc.ca. And we will build a frequently asked questions resource out of all your questions on these matters, and we'll be putting that on our website as soon as we can, so that not only the people that ask the questions, but everybody else who wonders the same thing will be able to find out those answers as we move forward. We will also try and post the webinar along with the PowerPoint presentation on our website, which is, once again, www.housing.gov.bc.ca/building. When the presentation begins, you can start typing your questions anytime as soon as they occur to you, so that we will have some questions to start asking at the break. Try and keep them short as possible if you can. We're going to go into lecture mode now to minimize noise distractions from unmuted lines for everyone. One final point before we begin, everyone participating in this additional webinar today is eligible to receive a certificate of attendance. You can get that by emailing us your name and company name to building.safety@gov.bc.ca, and we'll email it to you. Licensed residential builders or nominees of residential builders, and I saw some of those in the comment box earlier, you can count this for professional development credits. Now let's meet our presenter, Junichi Jensen, who led this project from early consultations to regulatory drafting to explaining it to you all today. Take it away, Junichi.
All right, thanks, John. So welcome, everyone, or welcome back, as the case may be. If you've been with us for an hour and a half already, thank you. The great news here is I actually have two pictures in this next set of slides, so that'll be the big excitement for this presentation. Hopefully the topic itself is enough to keep us all interested. I'm going to call out the slides as I go through them because we have a number of people just following along at home, I guess, due to the large numbers. We've exceeded the capacity of our web meeting, so I'm going to start with slide number 2, and so this is the second presentation titled Other Changes. And we're just going to run through a bunch of associated changes that were made on the latest set of revisions to the BC Building Code. So that's revision number 8, which is posted on our website, and you'll see the link is there on the screen. I guess I should read it out. If you're following along at home, it's www.gov.bc.ca/building codes. And so our previous webinar we just went through was on windows, doors, and skylights, and that will be posted as soon as we can on that website. I'm going to move on to slide number 3. So this is a small change to Article 3211 and Article 91044. The same or a similar requirement exists in both Part 3 and Part 9. Unfortunately, they were written slightly differently and had slightly different meanings. So this is really just an editorial change to both of those parts of the code. You can see we have a little bit different language here than what was there before, but it is hopefully clearer. And again, it's now synchronized between both parts 3 and part 9 of the code. Basically, this just clarifies that if you have a rooftop enclosure, it need not be calculated as a story in the building height in certain instances, and you can read those for yourself. So if the slides aren't working, sorry, we're just working on that. We're just going to reload them and see what happens here. Slide number 4, I will move on to Article 3468. This is about tactile warning strips on stairs. Some of you may not have noticed that this was missing from the 2012 code and may have continued on just as you always have with installing these tactile warning strips. Hopefully that's the case. If not, apologies. This was just something that got missed in the adoption of the 2012 code. We have about 5 to 8% variation in content from the national code, and we're sometimes less than perfect at integrating that content into the new code. And we thank people for their patience and for pointing out these errors as they come across them. So this is, again, this was an omission, accidental omission from the 2012 code that just got picked up. Should be hopefully no net change in the provision of tactile warning strips. Slide's still not working?
I'll have to open it in presenter mode and just share my screen.
Okay, we're going to try a different method here to share the slides again. We had, unfortunately, had this problem a couple months ago when we did the similar presentation. I'm now on to slide number 5. It refers to Article 3416. Is just a fixed cross-reference, a broken cross-reference. So the link was incorrect to, I'm not sure what it was before, but now correctly cross-links to clause 331.13.10b. So basically this is the operating force of a door providing access. And again, it was just to correct the broken link. So now correctly, cross-references to the requirements for accessible doors. So you see here the operating force is not more than 90 newtons, but if you do have an accessible door, it's got to be a lesser amount. So that's 38 newtons or 22 newtons for an interior door. I'm on to slide number 6. Hopefully we can now follow along. 91044, we just looked at this before. It's again about the rooftop enclosure not being considered a story in building height. So just to reiterate, this is also in Part 9. The language now aligns between the two parts, and the sentence is a little bit more clearly written, we hope. Slide number 7. So you'll see the theme here is there's a lot of very minor changes in this presentation, but we do get to some more significant ones as well. So this one is possibly one of those that's a little more significant. This is a correction to the ventilation provisions in Part 9. So they describe the use of a ducted forced air system to collect and distribute ventilation air. There's a change in the wording here for clarity, but primarily the change is to specify that the distances in question are measured from the point where the ducting intersects the return air plenum to the furnace air circulating fan cabinet. So this change really reflects the idea or the fact that the furnace fan may not actually be located inside the furnace. So there were some compliance issues because some people were coming across instances where the furnace fan was actually in the cabinet, and yet the code language specifically assumed that it was. So in some cases it was difficult or impractical to comply with that provision. So the reason for these distances, you want to have your you want to have your intake air for ventilation at these specified distances from the furnace fan, because that will sort of optimize the amount of ventilation air coming into your forced air system. If you get too close or too far away, you're going to either have too little or too much ventilation air coming through. Too much ventilation air, not a health problem, but you will suffer an energy penalty because that ventilation air is cold air coming into your hot heating system. Of course, if you don't have enough ventilation air, you could experience some health issues in the building. Moving on to slide number 8, still on the topic of ventilation. So two more corrections here to the ventilation requirements. Again, just errors in the code, but they do make a big difference for some buildings. Not only for the cost of compliance, but for health and safety as well. So the first change above, you'll see it's indicated in red. That formerly said negative 10, it's now negative 20 degrees Celsius. This is a permission to use a passive ventilation system. So if you have a small one-story building, rather than providing a full mechanical ventilation system, you can provide passive air inlets into the building in specified locations to provide your ventilation air. And these systems are proven to work only in these small one-story dwelling units. And so that actually includes a dwelling unit on a multi-story building, as long as that dwelling unit is only occupies only one story. So if you have a two-story dwelling unit, these provisions don't apply. So again, this is a cheaper yet effective option to provide ventilation air. That is now, because of this minor change to the temperature, is now available to more climate areas, and it is proven to work in those climate zones. So in Clause B as well, you'll see there was an error in the unobstructed vent area. So when you're providing these ventilation air inlets, they have to be a certain size in order to work effectively and can provide adequate ventilation air. I can't remember it formerly said 25 millimeters, which was an incredibly small amount and was just a typo. The unobstructed vent area basically refers to the area the air can flow freely through that vent. So it's the spaces in between the members of the vent. Slide number 9, again, about ventilation and really just some wording changes for clarity. This is about ventilation for a heated crawl space. And when you take this approach, the crawl space becomes a part of your conditioned space in the building. So you have to make sure then that it's connected in some way with the air in the rest of the building. and that is by providing these air transfer grills that go between the building and the crawl space. If you have a crawl space that's broken into different compartments, then you'll need an air transfer grill in each compartment. But the way that this was written before, people were misinterpreting that a larger crawl space might need two or three grills. But actually, the intent was just to require one grill per crawl space. But when the area of your crawl space is increased, then the area of that grill is required to be increased as well. Now, of course, you could comply by providing several grills if you so desire, but the intent is that you can also comply with one. So that may be more convenient or cost-effective in some instances. And this also clarifies that in no case can that grill ever be less than 25 square centimeters of unobstructed area. So again, that's the area of the openings in the grill. Does not count the slats in the grill. Slide number 10, still on ventilation. Growing pains, I guess, with these brand new set of ventilation requirements that was introduced in the 2012 code. You see an exception here, and this relates to sealing of ducts. So basically, if you have a combination furnace, forced air furnace, where you're piping your ventilation air in to that furnace air distribution system, you do not have to seal those ducts. It's still a good idea, but the research shows is that because you're moving such large volumes of heating air through these systems, it's not justifiable as a health and safety measure to seal the ducts. So again, you're going to get enough ventilation air through one of these systems regardless of whether the ducts are sealed or not. Still may be a good idea, but not a requirement of the code any longer. If you just have a pure ventilation system, like an HRV, for instance, you're still going to have to seal those ducts. So this is only if you're combining a forced air furnace with a ventilation system, a fresh air ventilation system. On to slide number 11. We still have some more on ventilation here. This is about the provision of makeup air. And the provision of makeup air used to be tied to the presence of radon and a gas mitigation system in the building. This was an error, as there is no scientific evidence that backdrafting from a large exhaust fan, such as an oversized kitchen range hood, increases the presence of radon in the building. So the reality is that these excessively large exhaust fans will actually draw air in through the building envelope and dilute the air in the building to a very high degree. Now, that's not the best way to deal with radon, but it is proven to work. The best way, of course, is to require a radon rough-in or a radon vent pipe, and that's why we've done that in Section 913 in this version of the BC Building Code. So, again, the best way to deal with radon is to give it a path to escape before it enters the building, and that's what that radon vent pipe does. These ventilation provisions have been disassociated from radon because there's no scientific evidence to prove that a large exhaust fan will increase the risk of radon in the building. On to slide 12. This is a funny one. We've updated all these appendix diagrams in revision 7. You will not see these updated diagrams in the replacement pages for the BC Building Code that are coming soon because we have to update them again for revision number 8. So if you do have access to the online version of the BC Building Code, then these are all up to date on there. If you go onto the BC Codes website or our website, you will find the updated diagrams on revision 8 to the code, and you can certainly access those for free. but just a warning not to use the diagrams from revision 7 because they have already been superseded. These diagrams are just illustrating how one of these forced air systems or these other ventilation systems actually looks in your building when it's installed, and it sort of lays out the different requirements for distances and heights of vents and stuff in a diagram form. So they've been changed to reflect the changes to the requirements that we discussed earlier. Last one on ventilation, I believe. There's a new note in the appendix for section 932. You can see there's a table discussing NAFVA appliance, so naturally aspirated fuel-fired venting or vented appliances. Essentially, a appliance that is subject to backdrafting, so it's not airtight, can possibly cause a risk of carbon monoxide in the building. So when you turn on your overly large or even potentially properly sized exhaust fan in your kitchen or bathroom, and you have a fuel-fired appliance, you run the risk of actually sucking some of that combustion, those combustion products back into your house, which of course we do not want to have. So you're going to have to provide some makeup air for that appliance if it is subject to leakage. This appendix note just clarifies that appliances designed to the mobile home standard for fuel burning appliances that are installed also to the mobile home standard, whether or not it's in a mobile home, those are non-NAFVA, so they are airtight and they do not need makeup air provided to them. So again, it is very important though that the proper installation procedures be followed. It is, I guess, reasonably common for someone to take a mobile home type appliance and put it in a home, a non-mobile home, and use a different installation method, but that can potentially short-circuit the airtightness of that appliance. So, and I think if we move on to the next slide, it's a pause for questions.
Okay, please type your questions into the link comment field on the left side of your screen if you are on link, or email them to building.safety@gov.bc.ca. First question, 932346 is a significant change, as most designs went to a mechanical venting system and now can do the whisper grill again. Will there be a bulletin on this or a revision to the bulletin that was issued in the past?
Okay, I'm just catching up on what 932346 is, so just bear with me for 1 second. This was the passive system, I gather. Right. Will there be an updated bulletin? I guess we can consider that. To be honest, it hadn't occurred to me that that was necessary, but I'll make a note of that for sure. What's the other part of the question, John?
Well, just will there be a bulletin or a revision to the existing bulletin, because it's a fairly significant change.
Right. So the approach we had taken on this was that the webinars that we have are basically taking the place of the bulletins. So the webinars will be posted hereafter on the website for people to watch at their leisure. Because there's such a high volume of technical content in these presentations, it would probably take me weeks to write a bulletin to reflect all the changes that have been made. Which is not to say it didn't take me weeks to prepare the presentation here, but it would be a doubling of efforts. So that was the principle, but I can certainly have a look at that ventilation bulletin to see if it could stand some updates.
I would also mention, too, that in addition to the presentations themselves, we're going to be trying to post cumulative Q&As for all the questions that people are asking in association with those webinars on our website, so that that will be another way that people can get some of the answers that they're looking for, not just the people who are asking the questions today, but others who may have the same question. The next question, can 93234 be applied to secondary suite areas?
93234, principal ventilation system air. Yes, excellent question. We've been looking at this one recently, and there are a couple of more proposed changes that are hopefully going to happen soon. If you go to section 936 of the code, or 37, sorry, now, that deals with secondary suites, there seems to be an indication that the provisions of 932 for ventilation can be used in a secondary suite, and that certainly was the intent. However, the language of the code is not perfectly clear on that, so we are hoping to change the language of 937 to make that a little bit clearer. If memory serves me, that's 937.219, perhaps. But the bottom line is the intent was to be able to use these ventilation provisions in a secondary suite. Of course, you do have to be very cautious when doing so. There are some specific rules about interconnecting the air systems in the suites, because that is a huge safety risk. Interconnected air distribution systems have the potential to circulate smoke between the suites in the event of a fire. So you will see that there's a requirement for a duct-type smoke detector between the air handling systems, if that is the case. There have been some proposals that an HRV can act in the same way. My opinion is that the code is quite clear on that and requires a duct-type smoke detector in between the suites. So a lot of people simply comply with these 932 provisions in each suite on an individual basis and do not interconnect the systems. That's always a way to go as well.
Next question, how is it that creating a tighter building, it is acceptable to create negative pressure and draw air through leakage points in the envelope into the building? Based on this, you are now potentially drawing moisture-laden air into a building through the envelope, which over time can cause damage to the structure. Is there any thought to requiring an interconnect for gas, fire, cooktops, and stoves, as these appliances generate carbon monoxide, and should no ventilation be turned on, the potential of the gas poisoning is greater and can occur?
So the I guess the simple answer is no. You know, I talked before a little bit about the principle of the as it relates to radon, of these oversized range hoods, and I guess the scientific evidence shows us that when you have these oversized exhaust fans, the dilution rate, even in these tighter houses, is sufficient that things like radon gas get dissipated enough and then exhausted through the building's exhaust system. They don't necessarily pose health or safety risk. And I think the what I'm told is the same applies for the presence or the drawing in of moisture-laden air through the basement. I mean, we do have already requirements for an air barrier, an air and vapor barrier in that basement slab or in the subslab area. So that should be handling a lot of it. Of course, there is potential still for some leakage through the building envelope, but we have no evidence to show that that is an active health or safety concern.
And perhaps one final question before we get back to the presentation. Will there be a size given for the supply air vents in common areas?
Supply air vents in common areas. Well, there are no further changes proposed at this time, so I guess the answer to that is probably no. but we can certainly connect on that offline if you have a compelling reason that those are required, I'd certainly be willing to look at it and open up a discussion within the branch here.
Okay, let's continue with our presentation.
No promises, though. Limited capacity for code changes, but of course we're always open to suggestions. So. Okay, so slide number 15, a little bit on energy efficiency requirements. So needless to say, there have been a few challenges with these energy efficiency requirements for Part 9 buildings. They are pretty complex and pretty comprehensive set of requirements, so not surprising to see a few issues popping up. This one in particular relates to mechanical, plumbing, or electrical system components in an outside wall, and basically was telling us that in no case can we reduce the insulation level that is required in the exterior wall, even if we had to account for something like a pipe or a duct in that wall. So this is, I suppose, a noble provision, but it turns out to be quite impractical. So we have specifically identified, and some people would argue that this permission was already there, but we have specifically identified that you can trade off these areas where you have a pipe or duct with other areas of the wall. So you're going to account for your reduced insulation in this part of the wall and make up for it in other parts of the wall by providing more insulation than necessary in other parts of the building. So there is that formal trade-off path. It's identified here, Article 936.211, by which you can do so. And so that's the addition here, is to specify that you can make a trade-off under that that article. Effectively, what happens, and here's where I get the fancy picture that I borrowed from somebody else. Effectively, what happens, and I'm taking our energy guy's word on this, Zach May, that he's done some calculations here, and so I think some of the numbers in the slide are actually incorrect, but for climate zone 4, if you have R20 bats on 16-inch centers, you're going to have extra insulation overall in the building already than what is actually required by the code, by section 936. So that's a code minimum of RSI 2.78 effective value. Now you could do a bunch of calculations and a formal trade-off in accordance with 936.211. And he tells me that what you're going to find in the end is that in climate zone, you only need to provide about R6 of insulation behind that pipe, or sorry, in front of that pipe, I suppose, in order to have your building conform overall. So, so apologies, it says R10 on the slide. That number is actually R6 in climate zone 4. Keeping in mind that you also get some insulative value from your drywall and your sheathing. Another requirement that comes up here is it says in the code that in no instance can you reduce that level of insulation to below 55% of the required RSI value for that wall. So at first glance, R6 looks like less than 55% of the requirement for that wall, but I'm assured that if you do those calculations, you account for your drywall, your sheathing, and all those other things in the wall, that you don't get below your 55%, and you just need to provide R6 in front of that pipe in climate zone 4. In climate zones 5 through 7A, it's about R7, but you do need to be using an R24 bat to comply. R24 bat will give you enough excess insulation in the rest of that wall that you can do that trade-off in your average house with an average number of pipes to still comply. So it's all averaged on average. Free to do the calculations on your own, but this is what we come up with sort of as an overall level. Yeah, so to that point, R22 bats, unfortunately, in climate zones 5 through 7A is not going to give you enough room to do those trade-offs. So you want to be using the R24 bats if you've got any pipes, ducts, or other things in your outside wall that you need to account for. Okay, on to slide number 17. So just another minor correction here. We had put in a note here, and this is 936.28. This should be a table referring to insulation in below-grade assemblies. We had put on what we deemed to be a helpful note that in Zone 4 you only needed perimeter insulation on the outside of the foundation for the first 1.2 meters. This was already the case in the code, but it was a source of quite a bit of confusion for a while. We've removed that note. It was not a necessary note. The permission, again, is already there. But now that that understanding is out there, the note is deleted. So, again, it doesn't change anything. If you're in applying the requirements of Table 936.28 for below-grade insulation, you'll note that in many cases that insulation is only required at the perimeter of the slab. On to slide number 18. These are just the objectives and functional statements of 936, so they weren't formally adopted before. I haven't seen any issues with that because 936 already provides us with three different compliance paths, prescriptive, trade-off, and performance path. So the likelihood of doing an alternative solution on Section 936, I think, is even slimmer. But if people are doing them, then the objectives and functional statements are now formally adopted into the code to provide you with that option. Slide number 19. So another appendix note change, and again for 936. And you'll see in the table there, under walls, we have changed that number to 9.5 millimeters. 9.5 millimeters, not by coincidence, is the same amount of space that one is required to have in the province of British Columbia to create a capillary break in your cladding assembly. So if you're doing a rain screen type assembly, you need that air gap behind your siding. That air gap has to be 9.5 millimeters. It is shown to add some insulative value to your building envelope. And because in 936 you have to count every element that is adding insulative value, or you may want to count every element that's adding insulative value in your building envelope, we've specifically given you that permission to do so here. On to slide number 20. This ties back to the earlier presentation about windows, doors, and skylights. If you were tuning in there, you learned that there is no longer a reference in Section 9.7 to site-built windows. Those will all go to Part 5. But if you do have a Part 9 building that has truly site-built windows, that will now have to conform to Part 5. Those site-built windows can still conform to the energy efficiency requirements in 9.36.273, and basically that gives you a simple method of compliance for site-built windows, doors, and skylights. It tells you when you need two panes of glass or three panes of glass and a thermal spacer and whatnot, as opposed to pushing you to the NFRC 100 standard or the A440.2 standard for energy efficiency of those windows, doors, and skylights. So just a simpler compliance method if you have a truly site-built window, door, and skylight in your Part 9 building. So slide number 21, and actually we're getting towards the end. Fire separation. So again, just a correction of cross-references. This one just didn't make sense because the numerical cross-references were incorrect, so just a little bit of housekeeping. should be no big surprises or major changes happening there. And really, that's it. So again, all this stuff was effective on December 11th of this year. It applies to building permits applied for on or after that date. So if you have a building permit that is active before that, it is not subject to these changes, although in some cases the changes are just practical or errata changes that you may find your building official willing to talk about accepting them, but you'll need to approach them on an individual basis because, again, technically the changes only apply to building permits applied for on or after December 11th. So that's it. I think
we have a few questions that people have asked to go forward. 97331 now requires a thermal break. In a Part 9 building, if the curtain wall was designed under Part 5, would the thermal break still be required?
97331 now requires a thermal break. I'm just trying to catch up. we have a bunch of changes, in particular to 9.7, so let me just have a look at what it says here in 97331. Metal frames. Metal frames shall incorporate a thermal break, so I'm going to assume we're talking specifically about a metal frame, window, door, or skylight. I'm sorry, John, what was the actual question?
In a Part 9 building,
yeah,
if the curtain wall was designed under Part 5, would the thermal break still be required?
Yes. Yeah, it would be. So let's just follow the bouncing ball here. Actually, I'm looking at the wrong version of the code, unfortunately. But I think if you go to Section 9.7, you're going to find that your window is still in scope. You're still in scope of Part 9. Your building is still in scope of Part 9, and your windows are still in scope of Part 9, but you're going to design them to Part 5. So there's going to be certain parts of Section 9.7. So, for instance, 975, the subsection that deals with security, that's still going to apply to the window. I believe this one is as well, although my online code is failing me, so I can't double-check. So apologies. I can follow up with you on a one-to-one basis after, if you like.
Next question. In 936, does site-built have the same significance as before Revision 8, a product outside the scope of NAPS?
That's an excellent question. Site-built is not defined in the code. It's actually not technically defined in NAPS either. It's, I think they use the terminology site-built systems or something like that. But we do have an appeal board ruling through our BC Building Code Appeal Board that related to site-built windows. Basically, that definition was that it literally had to be a product that was built on site. So typical manufactured products or a lot of things people call custom products, which are, you know, ordered in custom sizes but still manufactured in a factory, those are not site-built products. It has to be actually manufactured on the building site.
Next question. There are numerous homes being built with thermally broken aluminum windows, which do not meet the thermal requirements. Some builders are being told by these suppliers that they are able to meet thermal modeling the home and substitute better insulation or better heating systems to make up for poorer performing windows. Is this correct?
Under 936, you do have that option of performance path or energy modeling. I can't really tell you whether or not these houses comply because it's going to depend on a number of factors. But the factors that were mentioned certainly would come into it. When you're doing that energy modeling, you can use a program like HOT 2000, plug all your numbers in, your heating equipment, your windows and doors, your insulation values, all that stuff. And as long as you're meeting that that base, the same level of energy performance as a base house would be that is constructed to the code, then you're free to do pretty much whatever you want.
Next question. Can you clarify the implications of 93241 in regards to radon gas? Does this any change any requirements for radon gas pipe to the roof?
It doesn't change the radon requirements at all, but what it said before was that if you were in a radon area, that you had to comply with those specific ventilation provisions. So let me just have a look at what those were again. Right, makeup air. Thank you, Zach. You had to provide makeup air for if you were in a radon area, but again, there's no scientific evidence to prove that the provision of makeup air in a radon area is going to resolve any health or safety issues. We have the 913 radon pipe, and that is what intercepts the radon and gives it a path out of the house. That is the best way to deal with radon.
Next question. Is the use of airtight or airlock pot lights permitted without the use of a poly bag?
So the question, I guess, relates to Section 936 and the pot light itself would have to in some way be tied to and maintain the continuity of the air barrier. So most, to my understanding, most pot lights are not constructed to be airtight. So I guess one option would be to run your air barrier around the backside of that pot light can. It's also going to depend, I guess, in some capacity what type of air barrier system you're using, if it's external or if it's internal, if you're using spray foam to help with your air barrier. But in general terms, I'm not aware of any pot lights that are going to meet those air tightness requirements, if you have one. Right, and I guess Zach is whispering to me at the moment that there are some airtight pot lights, some pot lights that claim to be airtight, and in general terms, they don't stand up to the actual requirements.
Yes, I've actually seen those labeled in stores. Okay, a comment. Bumping to R24 BATS doubles the cost of insulation. That and the somebody to do the trade-off makes that a very impractical approach.
Well, that may be a true statement. I'm not sure. These requirements for energy efficiency come to us from the National Building Code. They've been adopted throughout the country. We're not alone in this. In general terms, this is where the industry is going. The solution we've come up with here, I think, is a very practical one to allow that trade-off path to be used where you have a duct or a pipe in your exterior wall. Otherwise, you're going to see even more cost increases as you try to account for that loss of insulative value, or you try to move all your pipes or redesign your entire house to have all the pipes and ducts on the inside walls. That would be a very impractical solution. I recognize that R24 BATs are more expensive. As they become more common, I would expect to see that cost decrease. Of course, I can't promise that. But, again, I guess really the bottom line is the use of the R24 BAT is one way to comply in the colder climate zones. External insulation is a way to comply as well. You're just having to meet that overall target for the overall R value of the house. So if you're losing R value because of pipes or ducts on the exterior and you provide R24 baths elsewhere, you're likely to make up that amount elsewhere in the building. So the point was, if you choose the R24 baths and you use that trade-off method for your pipes or ducts in the exterior wall, you're going to get away with that. it's going to be up to your building official whether or not they want to see a formal trade-off calculation being done, but we're assured that all you got to do is provide R7 worth of insulation behind that Piper duct and the R24 bats, and then you should meet that trade-off calculation. It's just a more practical approach to that.
R24 is also required in base construction, 16-inch on center. You need an R24 bat to meet the minimum requirements of the code already.
I'm not sure you're going to be...
Okay. I don't know if we need
that.
Going to pass a microphone to Zachary.
It's worth noting an R24 bat in climate zone 5, 6, and 7A is for base building 2x6, 16-inch on center construction. You require an R24 bat to meet the minimum requirements of the code already, so that buffer room should already be built in. An R22 bat doesn't always get you over the threshold in those climate zones, so that buffer room to allow the trade-off for drain pipes and vent stacks and exterior walls is sort of already built into minimum code compliance, just out of practicality of the products available in the market and what you have to do to meet that minimum threshold.
And of course, people have the option of going to an external installation and guessing that R24 bats are going to be more cost effective than the external insulation route.
Somewhat related to the same question, the graphic and discussion shows vents and pipes, but does this relaxation allow for less insulation for ducts? Ducts have a larger area, and a reduction of insulation on the exterior of a duct is much more significant from the point of view of heat loss. These ducts are for heating and ventilation. They circulate conditioned air. Is the intent to allow lower insulation value as a trade-off for ducts too?
Well, let's just move back to that slide.
936.25.
So that was slide number 15. Bear with me for 1 second.
It's worth being aware that the relaxation here that allows trade-off paths to be used here with mechanical, plumbing, or electrical system components such as pipe ducts or conduits, cabinets, chases, panels, or recessed heaters are examples. But there is a separate restriction, I believe in sentence either 5 or 7 around this in the same set of requirements, that says explicitly that despite this, you cannot do any trade-off or reduction in performance for ducts that carry conditioned air or pipes that carry hot water. And so you would have to be a duct that doesn't carry conditioned air to be able to do this. And an exhaust duct downstream of a fan might be an example of that, where you do have a duct that doesn't get captured by the restriction around not reducing the performance of insulation around a duct to carry conditioned air. If there are any further questions about specific examples, please email the branch. We'd be happy to answer them.
Next question. Are vent pipes required from the floor through the roof for radon venting if, as a modular builder, we build a basement model home, or will the radon venting system under the slab with a mitigation system terminating through the basement wall be sufficient?
I'm going to have to go back to my section 913, I think. Just bear with me for a moment.
If there's an unconditioned crawl space underneath the modular building, then I believe, I don't have the wording right in front of me, but the radon provisions do, what you've got there with an unconditioned crawl space is the ability, because you don't have a concrete slab, you've got the ability to install a radon mitigation system if radon's found to be a problem. And so if you have an unconditioned crawl space underneath your modular home, you don't actually have to put in the radon rough-in, because there's very little cost barrier to putting in a radon mitigation system underneath your modular home, assuming you have an unconditioned crawl space that's exposed to the ground underneath there in the future.
Next question, disappeared from my... I believe the appeal board decision number 1746 on site-built doors that Ginny refers to concluded the opposite, that site-built was products that fell under 975, colon, products outside the scope of NAFS.
So 975 is no longer a compliance option under the revisions that have been made. I don't have that appeal in front of me. My understanding of the outcome of that appeal was that site-built meant it was constructed on site. So the requirements for sections, the former subsection 975, true, if the product was actually constructed on the building site, then those requirements would have applied. But since we have removed that section of the code, at least as it relates to site-built products, those products now go to Part 5 for compliance with those provisions.
Next question. 936.256 does not specifically mention outlet and switch boxes. Are they just generally allowed?
So the list that we have there in 936.256, and I think that was still on sentence or slide number 15, refers to electrical system components, and then it has some examples thereof. So we don't necessarily, when we have one of these lists, it's not necessarily exhaustive, and that's why we use the terminology such as. So pipes, ducts, conduits are examples of electrical system components. I personally think that an electrical box is an electrical system component. I think it would be hard to argue otherwise, so they would be subject to this as well. And really that was the intent of providing this specific reference to the trade-off path, was to allow such things, including electrical boxes.
I think that's all the questions we have so far, and I remind people that if they want to continue asking questions, they can do so by emailing us at building.safety@gov.bc.ca. The proceedings from today will be posted on our website along with the answers to questions that have been developed in response to questions asked. And I have given you a bum steer on what our website was. I think Julie corrected it at one point, and a few people have received corrections on link, but I will give you the proper web address now. I guess I'm living in the past because it used to be our web address. The new one is www.gov.bc.ca/buildingcodes, all one word. For people who have been writing into us about certificates of attendance, the answer to a number of questions is yes, there are separate certificates for the two different webinars. The first one from 10 to 11:30, mainly focusing on NAFS, and the second one on other matters that were covered by the recent changes. And people can email us at building.safety@gov.bc.ca and give their company name, and we will email their certificates for both, if you did in fact attend both, to us. And I believe that's all we have for you today, so thank you very much for joining us, and have a great holiday season, everybody. Thank you very much.
Thank you.